Thank you, Lori. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce our keynote speaker who will be with us tonight and tomorrow. Reverend Dr. Sarah Griffin Lund is passionate about loving her family, God, and being part of faith communities. She is an ordained minister and has served as pastor to churches in Brooklyn, New York, down the street at Plymouth Congregational, in New Smyrna Beach, Florida. She holds degrees from Trinity University, Princeton Theological Seminary, Rutgers University, and McCormick Theological Seminary. She currently serves as a vice president at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, Indiana. Sarah received the Engel Preaching Prize from Princeton and the Bob and Joyce Dell Award for Mental Health Education from the United Church of Christ Mental Health Network in 2015 for her outstanding authorship and leadership in breaking the silence about mental illness in family and in church and offering healing and hope. Sarah is the author of the acclaimed Blessed Are the Crazy, Breaking the Silence About Mental Illness, Family, and Church, published by Chalice Press, and blogs at sarahgriffinlund.com. And I encourage you during tonight and tomorrow to please go and visit the resource room over across this floor in the North Sanctuary. Sarah's book is up for sale, as well as several others that would make great resources for your library as you build a mental health ministry in your congregation. And finally, Sarah serves on the leadership team for the Bethany Ecumenical Fellows, a program to nurture young pastors in their first 5 years of local church ministry. Sarah is married to Jonathan, and they are parents to a first grader named Carter. Please, if you will, welcome Reverend Dr. Sarah Griffin Lund.
It's so good to be here in this sacred space on this night where a lot of us are reeling from the events of this week. And so to be in a place where we can be honest and open, where we can honor each other's stories and honor each other's journeys, I know I feel privileged to be here. And so I'm here because of my family. It's incredibly supportive. As you'll hear, I share very personal stories about my family, and I do so with the blessing of my family. They know how important it is for us to begin having conversations about mental health and mental health challenges. So thanks to my siblings and my mother and my spouse and my son. I'm also really grateful to Christian Theological Seminary. It's in Indianapolis, and it's one of the seminaries of the Disciples of Christ. And I love that the seminary provides graduate training, Masters of Divinity, and also 2 degrees in mental health, marriage and family counseling and clinical mental health counseling. So a lot of our students there study and go on to become licensed therapists and counselors. Several students say, hey, I want to be prepared as possible for serving congregations. I'm going to have a clinical mental health counseling master's and a Master of Divinity. And I know in my training, I studied social work in a master's program and really found that that was so helpful in my understanding of the way people find healing and recovery. So I give thanks to Christian Theological Seminary for preparing people to be healers in the world, to be leaders and lovers. And thanks to President Matthew Bolton, who really blesses this ministry of mental health. So I couldn't be here without the support of the seminary, and I'm truly grateful. To Dan and your vision, for your passion, for your love, for your commitment to justice and to healing and wholeness and recovery, let's give him some appreciation. Thank you so much. I have have to say, it truly was a pleasure talking to Dan on the phone and planning the details. He is someone who takes joy in the details, and that's really a spiritual gift. So that's wonderful. And thanks to this congregation for having the courage to gather people of faith together to talk about a topic that for centuries has been ignored and hidden. That we are in a period of a social movement towards justice and equality for all people with disabilities. And I believe that mental health challenges are a real invisible disability that many people struggle with, and it's often hidden. So we are part of a national movement to unhide, to make visible the pain that so many people experience. Now, I'm kind of new at telling my story. I'll be 40 in February, and I've only been sharing the story for 2 years. So most of my life, I have worn a mask, is one way to say it. And wearing a mask has caused me to tell many lies, mostly lying to myself, and then lying to the church, and lying to God. And so if you've ever found yourself in a place of not being truthful about who you are, you know how damaging that can be to your own sense of your self-worth, and damaging to your relationships to God and to one another. Because what you realize at some point is because of the lies and the mask, nobody knows who you really are. And because nobody knows who you really are, you don't feel loved. Because you always think, if they knew who I really was, then they would not love me. And that's true for God. If God really knew who I was, God would not love me. If the church knew my real story, they would not accept me. And so for my whole life, growing up in the church, being called into ministry, serving as a pastor, serving as a judicatory leader, as a regional minister, I wore the mask, and I wore it beautifully. And the smile was there. And then I realized that it was all a lie. It was a way for me to survive, feeling protected. And it also kept me from knowing God and from knowing love. So it took a gathering similar to this size in a church. We're in the National Cathedral crypt. Has anyone been to the National Cathedral? It's a beautiful space. It was a conference for young clergy women from all over the world. Mostly we were from the U.S. We had a few of our sisters from across the pond. And we were so tired because a lot of us were brand new into ministry. And a lot of us lived in towns and cities where we didn't know another young woman in the ministry. So we felt very alone and isolated. And I was especially exhausted because I had just come from burying my father. Literally the day before I was conducting my father's funeral. So I was exhausted. And our guest speaker was Anna Carter Florence, who is a preaching professor at Columbia Theological Seminary. And she was there to talk to us about the importance of testimony. And she looked at all of us young, hurting women. You know, some of us were new mothers, and so our bodies were aching, and we were tired. Or some of us were single and wondering if we'd ever find a partner to share our lives with. And some of us were living in the closet, afraid to come out, afraid of what the church would think of us. Some of us were in rural communities and feeling very alone. And she spoke a word of hope and encouragement, and she looked at all of us in the eyes, and she said, "You need to tell your stories, because the stories of women, especially young women, have been silenced in the church. And we do not know God because of it. We cannot fully know God if we do not fully know one another. And so the silencing of any of our stories, whether you are a woman or a person of color or a person who is LGBTQ or anybody who is not, you know, on the main stage, anybody who is not elevated as a voice of authority, our stories are not often heard. And so she said that you have a God story to tell. And it's because of who you are as a woman. And that's the story the church needs to hear. And so that stirred something inside of me. Here I was, still crying tears because of my father's death, and connecting the dots of what was the story that God was calling me to tell because of my life. And that was the first time I realized that the story of severe and chronic mental illness in my family was a story that God was calling me to tell. And I was terrified. And I was beginning to heal as I put that story together, first in conversation and then in writing, and now in sharing the story. It's part of the healing and recovering that I've experienced. It's part of being an integrated self, a person of integrity, a person of authenticity. Brené Brown, some of us may be a fan of hers, and her work is so important because she talks about the power and importance of vulnerability in our society. So tonight, I'm going to share with you what I feel is on my heart that I'm called to share, and it is a testimony of sorts. It's a story about how in my life, I've looked back at all the broken little pieces and seen how even there in the shadows, even there in the brokenness, that God was there. And God is here with us, no matter who you are or what you've gone through. That is the testimony of faith. And so for me, it is a story of extremes. And I did not choose it. And that's why I've hidden it for so long. I didn't think people would believe it. But I'm here to share it with you tonight. And I want to show some footage from our family movies. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, my father was trying to capture every part of our life together. And so I've pieced together some footage from our time in Southern California, and it'll give you kind of a glimpse of some of my family dynamics.
Being ashamed, it's time to break the silence. We've kept it hush-hush too long. It's time for the church to become a place of welcome, a place of safety, a place of hope, a place of healing, because this is the good news. God's love is with us, even when there is, as my family puts it, crazy in the blood.
So mental illness is not supposed to happen to families like mine. My mom and dad met in Columbia, Missouri. That's where a lot of my family is today. And my mom had just finished her training to be an elementary school teacher. And her dream was to go to St. Louis with her girlfriend. They had already rented an apartment, and they both were going to be kindergarten teachers in St. Louis. Very exciting for my mother, who had lived at home all during her time at Stevens College, a college for young women. And then she met my father, and he swept her off her feet. He wooed her, and within 6 weeks' time, they were engaged. And her plans for St. Louis, well, she had fallen in love. And my father, his dream was to be an animal doctor, and his vision was to go to Southern California to Los Angeles and open an emergency animal hospital that had 24-hour care to little pets. And back in the 70s, that was a pretty new idea, late 60s, early 70s. And so my mom supported my dad through school, and they were off to California, where he had a motorcycle and loved to scare my mother by racing down those hilly roads on the motorcycle and flying through intersections at breakneck speed. And it was exciting. And my mom had always dreamed of being a mother to lots of kids. She had an aunt who had 6 children, and she thought, that's the kind of life I want to have. And so for 7 years, she tried to get pregnant and could not. Until she did. And she did 5 times in 6 years. Yeah. And nobody believed her that they were all her biological children. And I was the youngest of the 5. So my sister Susan is 6 years older than me. Susan, there's Scott, Steve, Stuart, and Sarah. My mom swears by the time she got to Stuart, she didn't really know they all had S's. And so it took her a while to figure that I should be an S as well, Sarah. So what happened was, during this time, my dad was very successful as an animal doctor, and his business grew. He had a partner, and they built their business, and the animal hospital had an apartment next to it because it was an emergency room 24/7, so sometimes people would sleep there and have their shifts. He was elected to school board, and so a great civic leader. They were leaders in Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church, and things were going well. My dad had this amazing energy and a brilliant mind and very creative. And as little kids, we remember things like turning lawnmower engines into go-karts. And he was the first one that we knew to get a home computer, you know, right when those were made available. And home video players, I think they were like these huge discs and cartridges. And we had all of that. He got his pilot's license, and he would take my brothers up flying with him, and they would fly the airplane, you know, as 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds. And he wanted to expose us to life. And so we went on all these RV trips to all the national parks. And it was intense. It was a lot. And it was adventurous. And it was fun. And he wanted to show us what it was like to operate on animals. And so at a very young age, he would bring us all to the hospital, into the operating room, and have us watch and participate in these surgeries. Not me, though. I was too little. So I was in the room hanging out with the cats and dogs. And I liked that. But my older siblings were actually operating on animals when they were 12 and 13 years of age. So can you pick up on any themes here with my dad? Mania. So, none of this was spoken of. None of this was talked about. I don't even think at the time it was seen as odd or troublesome. It was a great life, and we were upper middle class. My dad made good money. And so the second home they bought with all the kids was on this beautiful property in La Habra Heights. And I'm not proud of this, but we were one of the families in California that hired women from Mexico to care for the family. And so Gina was a woman from Mexico that my mom and all her friends would do this. It seemed pretty normal. But looking back, of course, we know that that was not the way that we want to treat people. Because the way Gina got paid was by going to Montgomery Ward's and buying appliances and shipping them to Mexico. She had children in Mexico, but she was to care for the 5 of us. And we had gardeners, and the gardener and Gina had a baby together, and that baby was part of our family. And so my dad's mania started to get a little off kilter, looking back, putting the pieces together, when he was not sleeping for several days. And that's really when things began to shift for him. And all of the success and goodness we experienced from that aspect of his brain chemistry really backfired. Because without sleep, something was triggered. And what was triggered was paranoia and delusions and real fear. And it turned toward his children. And so the real dis-ease began. He would disappear and he would reappear. He would sleep for days. He would be manic for days. He would take us to the drive-thru and we'd order 20 hamburgers for 5 people and drink gallons of milk at a time. And so I, as a little girl, began to sleep with my mother in the big bed because Dad was gone. And with Dad being gone, we had no money to keep up our lifestyle. And so we had to figure out what to do. Still, even at this point, there was no sense that he was ill or sick. There was just a sense that he was doing what he wanted to do. And so my mom began to worry and talk to our Lutheran pastor about what was happening. She was concerned. And she was concerned because my dad looked at my oldest brother, Scott, and Scott was starting to become an angsty teenager, you know, 13, and in California, skateboarding was popular, and he had a mohawk and listened to punk music. You know, pretty typical teenage stuff. But in my dad's mind, because he had this undiagnosed mental illness, he was reading into these behaviors things that weren't there. So he was viewing this behavior of my brother as satanic, and that Satan was out to get him and his family. And the only way to destroy Satan was to, you know, yeah. And so this worried my mom. And so our pastor said to get into Christian counseling. And my dad refused. My dad did not think there was a problem. Well, he did, but the problem was Satan and the voices and the paranoia and the real sense that he had of a spiritual warfare and a crisis that he had to fix. And so we went to the Christian counselor, the 5 of us kids and my mom, and we sat in this room. It was really dark in this room, I remember it. And I remember sitting next to my brothers and sister. And the counselor said, "Raise your hand if you think that you should leave your father. Now raise your hand." And I remember my stomach just clenching and tightening, and I remember feeling so small and afraid, because I didn't know what to do. It wasn't long after that where my mom started kind of hatching this plan, and it was a plan to leave my dad, because she really wanted him to get help and to get treatment, but he was not in a place to acknowledge there was any problem. After school, my dad decided this was the day that he was going to exorcise Satan from the home. And the way he was going to do it was by taking all the paraphernalia that was related to Satan, all the skateboards, the punk music, all of that. So he's getting all this stuff from my brother in my brother's home, and of course, not really tolerating this, and they're fighting. And I was terrified. Somebody's going to die. Who is it? I don't know who's going to win this battle. And so my dad was 6'3", like huge man. So he won, and he got all the stuff, got in the truck to take it to the city dump, I guess. My brother chases him outside to the driveway and reaches into the truck to get his stuff back. And my dad is on a mission. So he reverses the truck. He takes off. And my brother falls out of the car. And my dad runs him over. My brother hits the driveway and has got a concussion and a fractured leg. And my dad's gone. And we're there in the driveway. So my sister calls 911, and they come, and he's taken in the ambulance. My mom's at work. And as I look back and talk to my mom about what happened, She remembers being at the hospital, standing next to my brother Scott, who was in the hospital bed, and the police come. And the police officer says to my mom, "Do you want to press charges?" So what do you think my mom said to the police officer? Why would she say no? Scared? Well, she turns to my brother, Scott, her son, who's recovering from a hit and run and abuse by his dad, fractured leg, stitches in his head, and she says to my brother, her son, she says, "What do you think we should do?" And what do you think my brother says? No. No. Now, why would that be? So it's kind of textbook domestic violence, the cycle of violence. It's very complicated. It's so difficult to escape the cycle of violence, the abuser. And so my mother said, "No, we will not press charges." And, you know, you look back and you say, what if? You know, what if? But what she did do is she hatched a very good escape plan. And my dad knew this, something was up, so he tried to prevent us from escaping, slashing car tires. And my mom, as a teacher, she knew how important education was. She decided to wait till we finished school. And so really the first day of summer, we were out of there. And we had a big Suburban with blue and white stripes. My sister had just turned 15 and got her permit. So she got to drive us from California to Missouri. I'm sure she loved that. In the Suburban was a huge roll-top desk and a grandfather clock. Those were things my mom insisted that we not leave behind. And each of us five kids got a pillowcase. So whatever we could fit, that's what we were able to bring. And mine was a strawberry shortcake pillowcase. Yeah, of course. But, you know, we were terrified. And because we were escaping a violent situation, it was a secret. And so we could not say goodbye to anyone. We could not tell anyone. And the whole plan was we're doing this until Dad gets better. You know, when Dad gets better, we'll all be together again. I'm so glad she got us out of there. But going to Missouri did not stop my dad, because he remained obsessed and fixated on this idea that there was a plot now, and it was a communist plot to destroy him and his family. And people were watching, and people were out to get us, and he had to save us. And now he said my mom was a lesbian, and he had to save us from her. And so he tracked us down. We were at my mom's parents' house, and so he would call and make harassing phone calls. And we were terrified. My dad, like I said, was big. I was a little girl, terrified of my dad. And so we went from this lifestyle and to having nothing. This is how mental illness, when it's untreated and undiagnosed and when it's severe, it really devastates families in terms of economic stability. And so we would have been homeless if it weren't for the compassion of my grandparents who took us in. So we had to rebuild our life. And my mom was a substitute teacher, and we entered into this new school district. We got on welfare, food stamps, free lunch, all of that. And I'm about 8 years old, and so what do I care about? Friends, having friends. I want people to like me. You go to Salvation Army and Goodwill, and you find all the name brand clothing so people don't know you're poor. The little triangle on the jeans. That's really important when you're like 8 years old. Guess. Get the guess bag. All of that. So I was faking it, right? That's the mask. I'm not poor. My dad's not mentally ill. I'm not in a dysfunctional family or situation. I'm fitting in. I'm just like everyone else. You go to school in the public school system and you have free lunch back in the 80s. It's very demoralizing because you go up to the cash register, you have your lunch tray, you're with your friends, and you say to the cashier, free lunch. And then, how does that feel? It's like, oh. So we got food stamps, and my plan was I'm going to hide the fact that I'm free lunch. And so with the food stamps, we're going to buy lunch food. And I'm going to get all the name brand lunch food so I can fit in. And then I'm going to hide it under my bed so my brothers don't eat it. So I have food for lunch. So that's what I did. See, I'm really good at hiding things, wearing the mask. And during this time, my dad kidnapped my two brothers. He told my mom, you know, he really missed us. He really wanted to see my brothers. And my two brothers missed him, you know, their father. And so for the summer, for 2 weeks, she sent them to Dad in California. He was living in an apartment. And when we would call and talk to my brothers, they couldn't believe how Dad was living. Hoarding, and so nothing was thrown away, and eating fast food, and not cleaning his apartment. And my brothers both developed really, really severe asthma. And my mom wanted them back, and he wouldn't send them back. And school was starting up, and my older brother, Steve, said, well, I want to stay with Dad. I like California. I like being near my friends. You know, I'm going to make this work. So he sent the middle brother back, Stuart. And when my mom picked him up at the airport, she was expecting two sons back, but there was just the one. And he was mute. He could not speak from the trauma. Because he felt, how do you think he felt? My dad keeping the other son and sending him back. And my dad had said things to my brother Stuart growing up, that he was gay. He stuttered, called him a retard. And so this muteness just really accentuated my brother's struggles. And he was in special education class, and back then it wasn't viewed in a way that was really inclusive. And so he suffered greatly because of that trauma. So we just got on as best we could, covering it all up, hiding it. We didn't see any therapists or counselors. We didn't tell anybody any of this was going on. My dad would keep calling us, sending us these big packages filled with literature from Lyndon LaRouche, which was a political party that he thought if we joined, it would bring the family together. If we just signed on to his political party, it would fix everything. So I came to see these packages from my dad as like care packages. You know, it was a sign that he thought about us and loved us. And when he called and ranted on the phone, I listened because I was waiting for him to say something that made sense, something I could connect to. He managed to always have friends who would take care of him because at this point he's lost everything. So he went for several years living with different people because he was a kind person. And at first, people really wanted to take care of him and take him in. But then they started to see these other things. And he would go from place to place, living in his car. He squatted in one property for about 7 years. So we never really knew where he was, if he was homeless or not. But I didn't tell anyone that this was the life I was living. And was able to find kind of father figures in the church. Had a wonderful senior pastor who every Sunday the message was about love and it was about God's love and how much God loved me. And as a little girl, I really took that to heart. And I think that's one of the things that saved me, that I was in a church that every Sunday they would convey that message with sincerity, and it saved me. I had some wonderful soccer coaches, father figures who, again, nurtured and cared for me, even though they didn't have a clue what was going on. I had a young girl that I babysat, and her parents had a Wednesday night Bible study, so every Wednesday night, they lived in this huge home, And I loved going to their house. It was so clean. It was so nice. And we got to eat pizza. And it was like a retreat for me. It was this beautiful home. I was so embarrassed about where I lived. We lived in this little dinky house. And my mom was so stressed out and tired from raising five kids. It was always dirty. She didn't have time or energy to clean. We always ate off of paper plates. Our dinners were frozen burritos, you know. We got by. But it was no place I'd ever want to show anyone or ever have anyone over to my home. So I loved going to this nice house to babysit and did that for about 2 years. And when my book came out and that family read my story, they came up to me in church and they were weeping. And they said, "Sarah, we had no idea what you were going through all that time when we saw you every Wednesday. We just didn't know." And they didn't know because I didn't want them to know. And they said if they had known, they could have, you know, offered some help, some support. My brother Scott, who had been run over, he had his first psychotic break as a high school senior. Brilliant, you know, on his way, full scholarship to college, and his brain was impacted by a chemical imbalance. And he had cashed out all of his savings. We all had to work hard to help make ends meet, paper routes, busboys, babysitting, everything. And he had about $200 in cash that he got in $1 bills, and he went around giving money out to people at school. And he had shoe polish that he painted his body. And so they knew something wasn't going well for him. Went to the principal's office. My grandparents picked him up. And later that night, he was just so frantic and upset. He wanted to end the pain. He was trying to stop the pain in his brain. And so he wanted to just make it stop. And that scared us all. My mom called 911, and they came and put handcuffs on him, took him to the hospital, where he was entered into the psychiatric unit. He escaped. I don't know how he escaped, but he did. And he came home. I don't know how he got home, but he did. And then we sent him back, called 911. He went back in, and it was right around Christmas break. Did we tell anyone in the church? No. Did we tell any of our friends or neighbors or family? No. Scott, unlike my dad, got treatment. He saw a psychiatrist, he saw a psychologist, got on medication, and was able to go to college and go to graduate school. He got married. He became a professor of biochemistry, and his wife became a professor of child psychology. And he did all of this because he was in a program, and part of his recovery was a 12-step group. And it was also reconnecting with our dad. And so I am grateful that my brother's recovery encouraged him to talk about what had happened growing up, because none of us did. We wouldn't even talk to each other as siblings or talk to our mom about what had happened, not breathe a word. And so it was my brother who said, you know, "I've been so pissed off and mad at Dad for destroying my life and running me over. But if I'm going to get better, I have to reconcile." And so he was the first one in our family to turn to our dad with compassion, the very child who had been the most directly abused. And that inspired me. And so we began to reconnect with our dad and schedule times to see him, always in public, and always a very short amount of time that we could see Dad, usually like at a Denny's restaurant, just for a meal, and that was all we could take. Still undiagnosed, untreated, still living in his mind that was really impacted by the severe bipolar with some schizophrenia. My dad wasn't the only one in his family to have this severe mental illness. His sister also suffered from mental health challenges. And the way we knew was that she took out her anger and fear and aggression onto her children, onto the children that she adopted. She adopted three kids. Two are twins and a sister. And the boy that was the twin, Paul, was in a cast when she adopted him as a two-year-old because his birth family had abused him physically and sexually and emotionally. And Paul never recovered from any of that. And so as a teenager, he acted out multiple forms of addiction, sex addiction. He was addicted to pornography, and he had a low IQ as well. He had some learning disabilities and some brain damage. And he would abuse his sister. And so we knew this because we knew that our aunt would punish him. We would visit every summer. We knew that she would handcuff him to the bed at night, that she had a special, those big chests. So she had a chest that she would have him go inside. And she would do other things that we thought this was really strange. And they are our farm cousins. And Paul's doing things that aren't right. Paul's acting out, so we didn't. So my senior year of high school, Paul is now 18, and he is on his own, and he goes and gets arrested for a lot of petty crimes, and he was arrested for public urination. But that's not a very bad sentence. I mean, it's a few days in jail, and he gets out of jail, and he comes to our house, and he sees my mom and I in the driveway, and he says, "Aunt Jenny, I need $20 because I need gas money to drive back home." And home is Clarksville, Missouri. So my mom gives him the gas money, and he's on his way. And we don't have to deal with him anymore. 2 days later, we find out Paul's been arrested for murder. And we never imagined that Paul would murder anyone. He wasn't a violent person. Yet the evidence was all on his body and in his car. There was a woman in the community, it was a wife and a mother of young children. They had a horse for sale, and he went to the home to ask about the horse. But what happened then? How could he do such a thing? That night after the crime, he helped a woman with a flat tire. He helped her change her tire. So Paul was brought before a jury. And he had state-appointed attorneys who tried to argue to the jury that Paul was a person who from birth was abused and neglected, that he had mental illnesses, several, and that he never had a fair chance in life, and that Paul was a person who suffered from the inability to think rationally. And when he committed this crime, he was in a state of psychosis. And the jury in Missouri heard that, and they also decided that he was guilty and should be punished by death. And so they sentenced him to death at the age of 20. And that's when I was a senior in high school. My father is homeless and living with severe mental illness. My cousin has just been sentenced to death. And so what do I do? What would you do? Well, I got as far away from home as possible. But, I didn't think about seminary as a senior in high school. I was an atheist by that point. I had heard about God's love, and maybe I felt it a little bit. But at this point, God was gone. So I went to Trinity University, which is a Presbyterian-related school, as an atheist, and I thought, well, now I'm just going to forget my family, forget all of that. I'm a new person. Who knows who I'll be? I'll be whatever I want to be. And when I move into the dorms, the first person I meet, she's like four rooms down from me, is a woman named Naomi Pitamber. And she's a native San Antonian. She's a Pakistani-American. She's a pre-med major. And she's a Southern Baptist born-again Christian. And she's got beautiful brown skin and brown eyes and brown hair and sings this incredible voice, plays guitar. And I was fascinated by how someone as smart as her, you know, pre-med, could think that Jesus was like a boyfriend, you know, the way she talked about Jesus. I mean, it was, come on, I was like, oh my gosh, can you believe her? So, so we just really hit it off. And I was just so lost and so ready to start over that we got involved in a campus ministry and Bible study. You know, really getting into the scriptures, really looking at the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. And what is Jesus all about in the Gospels? What is Jesus doing most of the time? Healing. And what kind of people does he heal? People who are sick, right? Wow. Okay, God. Yeah. I was pretty broken and sick myself because I hated my father, and that was making me sick, and I hated myself. And so I was able to give God a chance. And give Jesus a chance and say, okay, I need to be saved from this hatred. And through that Christian community and the blessing of college life where you have free time, you have some free time. So I really got into the Bible studies and prayer and people praying for me. And that's when I felt this radical possibility of resurrection in my life. The sense that all that had happened to me could be transformed. And I was baptized again. I didn't care who baptized me. I just knew I needed to have a physical sign that my life was new and different. And my Southern Baptist friend happened to know a lot of ministers who would just put me on the rolls for baptism. I didn't know the pastor either. I didn't really care. But it was Easter Sunday, and they like to do baptisms then in the Baptist church. And what I remember is the pastor, you know, dunking me under and then hitting my head. But, you know, it was fiberglass. It didn't hurt, but it was really loud. It was like this big, loud sound and, you know, coming up just wet and feeling really, really free. And knowing that my life from then on was really God's. And looking at Jesus and what he says about people in jail and in prison. Sister Helen Prejean came to my university, and I went to hear her speak. And she's an incredible advocate for people sentenced to death. Dead Man Walking, amazing story. And you know, that's when I remembered I had a cousin on death row. Because I had been able to totally block that out of my mind. And her testimony and the studies of the life of Jesus said that I needed to reconnect to my cousin. So we started writing letters. And the really cool thing was that while God was working in me a sense of calling to ministry, God was working in Paul a sense of calling to ministry. And on death row, he had been so targeted by the other men and abused by the men on death row, that he requested isolation. So he was isolated and spent time with the chaplain and would write to me letters about his faith and his walk with Jesus Christ and poetry about God. And he was so excited that I was going into the ministry. I went to seminary and knew that I had to focus on this social justice and social work, that was part of healing, studying psychology, trying to understand my life and how mental illness had impacted it. So I knew my ministry would focus on healing. Senior year in seminary, ready to graduate, and I get a letter from Paul saying that he's found out he's going to be executed in 30 days. And he asks if I will come and be his spiritual advisor. Will I come and witness his death? And the date that he's going to be executed fell right into finals week, my senior year of seminary. So I go to the dean of students, Victor Hernandez, and I say to Victor, the first time I told anybody I had a cousin on death row, but I said to the dean, my cousins asked me to come. It's finals. What should I do? And what do you think the dean said to me? He said, go. He said, that is holy ground. I was so mad. I mean, right? He was sending me to death row. I was in seminary. I mean, I was training to be a minister. I mean, oh. So thankfully, my brother Steve and my sister, who are both medical doctors at the time, and myself, my cousin Paul, he wanted all of us to come. He wanted his twin brother to come and witness the execution. He wanted his little sister to come and witness, but they just could not. And my brother Scott, he could not. And my brother Stuart could not. So it's a very rural part of Missouri where they execute people. It's a huge industrial complex. And what percentage of people in prison and on death row have mental illness? You know, it's a lot. And so first time I've been to death row was to minister to my cousin. And I found out a lot of things. I found out that there was a woman from Vermont who had been his pen pal for 10 years and regularly wrote letters to him. And that's who he wanted to call for his one phone call. And he got to talk to her. I found out that he also wanted to be reunited with his birth family. And his sister made that happen. And so the day before he was executed, his birth mother and father came to see him. First time they've ever seen him since he was 2 years old. And Paul said he was really glad they came. And he was really disappointed. Because they were still doing drugs. And they did not acknowledge that they had anything to do with where he was. So when I saw Paul, I was brought down into the place where they prepare him to be executed. And he was in a cage. A metal cage. And this square here, it was about half the size of this square space. And in the cage was a wooden box the size of a coffin, and that was where he was to sleep for 3 days while they were preparing him for execution. And he had on white cotton pants and a white cotton shirt and white canvas shoes and white socks. And I was to be seated in a plastic lawn chair that was bolted to the ground. And there was a yellow line on the floor so that I could not go past that yellow line. I could not touch the cage, and I could certainly not touch Paul. And so there we were, and he had the TV going. He said, you know, Sarah, I can watch any movie I want. They'll let me see any movie I ask for, and I can watch it. And he said he really wanted some chocolate cake and some grilled cheese. But they didn't have chocolate cake. And he wasn't really that hungry. And he didn't really have anything he wanted to say for his last words. So we talked about motorcycles, Harley Davidson. We remembered how our grandfather would take us out on horse rides with the horses on the farm. And then the nurse said that we had 5 more minutes. And then Paul realized what was going to happen. He had been in denial the whole time. And then I realized I had 5 minutes to communicate to him the gospel, the reassurance of the presence of God. And before the nurse left, she said, "Paul, can I get you some anti-anxiety medication? Because I think you might be feeling anxious right now." Paul didn't want that. In fact, he just shut down, curling up into a ball in a fetal position on that little wooden box. And he couldn't look at me. He could barely breathe. And so before I was escorted away, I said, "Paul, I love you. And God loves you." And the guards took me away. And they showed me the platform where we view the execution. Again, the plastic lawn chairs bolted down. A little window with mini blinds. And on the loudspeaker, there's a countdown. 3, 2, 1. The mini blinds open. And there's Paul. And he's on a white gurney with an IV. And he's got his glasses on because with his glasses, when he turns his head, he can see us. And he turned his head, and then his eyes were closed. And the mini blinds closed, and the guard said, "You have to go now." And the guard says to me, "Ma'am, don't forget your Bible." And I said, "Don't forget Paul." And we go out into the parking lot, and there are two sisters with their votive candles. They've been holding vigil. And Paul's twin brother is there, weeping. Because he knows what has just happened. He's felt what has happened. And we leave. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning. I go back to seminary. And that night in Missouri, when Paul was executed in Princeton, New Jersey, there was a vigil on the chapel steps with seminary professors and students holding a light of hope. I gave a testimony on campus at Princeton. And an international student came up to me and he said, "I can't believe the U.S. treats its citizens that way. They're so critical of human rights in other nations. How could they do that to their own people?" Right out of seminary, I came to Minneapolis, to Plymouth Congregational Church. And I was wearing the mask, not telling my stories, but knowing that I needed to heal and that I had experienced great trauma and I needed help. So I got into counseling here at Second Presbyterian Church, or there's a Presbyterian, Westminster. Westminster had, they hope they still have their counseling center. It really helped me for 2 years. I got into clinical pastoral education at a women's workhouse, trying to process all that had happened. And I was part of an effort in 2003-04 when Minnesota wanted to bring back the death penalty. I was part of a coalition that was able to witness to the Senate. And I was able to tell my story about Paul. And they voted not to reinstate the death penalty. And part of the story I was able to share was that Paul was a person who the state rescued from harm and neglect. The state pulled him away from his birth family to save him. And then the state killed him. And all that he suffered from. Here in Minneapolis, I met my husband. If we fell in love going around the lake, the chain of lakes. And we met in the wintertime. We were both reading the Da Vinci Code. It was awesome. And so we got married, and by this time I'd come to Florida to be a pastor of a small church a mile from the beach. So Minnesota to the beach in Florida, you know, it's a good deal. So planning to get married, my sister had our dad walk her down the aisle. It was really surreal, But as you know, in families, we all have different experiences growing up, and he was much healthier during her childhood. So for him to walk her down the aisle, it was what she wanted. Not so much for me. We didn't know where he was, but we did have an address that he was the last time we knew. So honor thy father and mother for me. Send Dad the invitation to the wedding, you know. So we're getting ready for the wedding. It's 2 days before. My dad calls from the local train station, and he's shown up on the train from California to Missouri. And my brother Steve picks him up, takes him to Penny's to get new outfit, new shoes, gets him a hotel room, gets him showered and cleaned. And my solution to the whole walking down the aisle thing was my brother Scott, because he was married, but because of his chronic mental illness and our dad's and this real sense that in our family it's highly genetic, that was my brother's understanding, they didn't want kids. They didn't want a chance to bring in someone in the world that would suffer as he had suffered. So I was excited to have my brother Scott walk me down the aisle. But when he heard that our dad was going to be there, he said, "Sarah, I can't. I'm afraid of Dad." Oh. Do I walk down alone? So I said, "Scott, would you walk me down the aisle if Steve and Stuart were with you?" And he said, "Yeah." And so all three of my brothers, that's my favorite picture from the wedding, is me and my brother on this side, Scott, and Steve and Stuart on this side. We were like children again. We were so afraid of our father because we didn't know what would happen. You know how tightly choreographed weddings are? You know, every photograph is planned and plotted, so, you know, who's in what pictures when. So the big family picture, my dad wasn't in that one. He wasn't supposed to be there. So it was very surreal to be standing, getting my bridal day photo with my family and looking out at the photographer, and right behind her in the last pew is my dad. He was sitting there by himself, kind of eyes, you know, just kind of looking up the ceiling. And I didn't talk to him. I didn't say a word to my dad the whole wedding. He was at the reception, and it was the end of the reception. I was getting ready to go, and I thought, I want to go thank my dad for coming. And so I'm headed over to see my dad, and he's sitting by himself, and he covers his mouth, and he puts his arm out, and he says, "Don't get near me. I love you and I'm proud of you, but don't get near me because I'm sick. I don't want to get you sick." "Okay. I love you too, Dad. Thanks for coming." And then my husband and I go and have our wedding night. And my dad's sister, who lived on the farm, whose adopted son has been executed, he thinks he's going to live with her on the farm. And so they try it for a few weeks, and he's hoarding things from the junkyard, and she can't stand it and puts him on the train back to California. And the two siblings who were in doing the operations as kids and surgeries, well, they're medical doctors now. So when they saw our dad at the wedding, they knew that he was a ticking time bomb, that he was going to have a cardiac arrest at any moment. Because what we know is people with severe, chronic, and untreated brain disorders, everything else in their body shuts down. And that was the case with my dad. My brother Steve was so concerned, he flew out to California and got my dad into an indigent care facility. And he wouldn't be homeless. You know, we were so afraid he would die homeless. We imagined that was a real fear. So about 6 months after I was married, we got the call that he was dead, that he had a massive heart attack in his sleep at the care facility. And he had a wallet with $20, And he had a certificate of communion from the Catholic Church that somehow, within the past 6 months, he reconnected with his faith and was embraced in the Catholic community. So my church I was serving, I told them that I would be gone on Sunday because I had to go to my dad's funeral. And these good people were shocked. They thought, Sarah, you're so young. How could your dad be dead? I said, oh, he had a massive heart attack. So I got all of these Hallmark cards. You know, the cards that talk about the father and daughter relationship and the sweetness of that. And something in me just, I was so angry. They didn't know. I didn't tell them. I didn't tell anyone. Talk about complicated grief. The secrecy and the shame and all the layers. It wasn't until my father's obituary that we said a word to anyone about his mental illness. We asked for gifts to be given to NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. I didn't never told my church about my dad. But my brother Scott, at this point, his bipolar was getting unmanageable. And when I was pastoring that church, his wife so much wanted a baby and couldn't live with my brother anymore. And so she called me and said, I'm going to divorce your brother. He's down in Florida visiting you. You need to be with him. And you need to know what's going to happen. So he was at my house and I hid all the knives. And my husband had a BB gun. I thought I should hide that. And she called and told him that she was leaving him. He had been fired from his job because the administration thought he was too harsh on the students. He was giving too many low grades. And there must be something wrong with him as a teacher. And so fired from his job, divorced from his wife, how do you think he did in that time? Many cycles in and out of the psychiatric hospital. I had sat at his wedding. I had sat at his graduation from UCLA with a PhD. And I had to sit in a makeshift courtroom as the judge read a litany of his mental health disorders and hospitalizations and ruled that he was not of sound mind to make any decisions about his life. And my brother had asked that I testify on his behalf, that I say to the court and to the room that my brother was of sound mind, that he was fit to make decisions, that he would be okay on his own. And it broke my heart to tell my brother, I can't. I can't do that because I'm so afraid that if you were on your own, you would die. You have to stay in the hospital. You have to get help. You have to get better. And so, a day off of work at church, didn't tell anybody what I was doing, but I went down to the court hearing and sat as the judge made his ruling. And the secrecy and the shame. We were ashamed. We were ashamed that my dad had such a severe chronic mental illness. We were ashamed that he was homeless. We were ashamed that he heard voices. We were ashamed that he believed in communist plots, that he believed in creating underground tunnels to connect continents. We were ashamed that my brother, who was going to find the cure to cancer, that he was now fully disabled. Why were we ashamed? What is that about? That type of shame. Where's the compassion and mercy? When we view people as not failures or monsters, but as human beings who are in pain and are in need of support of healing and recovering. My husband suffered from severe and chronic mental illness and anxiety, and self-treated with alcohol and drugs. And it wasn't until we had our first child that it all exploded. And so I had married someone with mental illness. And so I know this intimately, and in my own life have experienced anxiety and insomnia as a postpartum episode. But was too ashamed to tell anyone or ask for help. Thought I could just get through it on my own. But it's not worth it. It's not worth it to live that way. And what I know is as the church, we're called to see one another for who we truly are, to see Christ in one another, to view each other through the lens of compassion, to stare death in the face and say, in this cross, there is resurrection. In the psych ward, there is hope. There is recovery. In the valley of the shadows, there is life. But we have to go there and see what is there in the shadows and stop pretending. Psalm 23 has shaped my understanding of God and this belief that even though you are there in the shadows, God is there. And so I want to share with you a verse of Psalm 23 that has given me life, and I offer it to you however it may touch your heart. Jesus is my light and gives me all that my spirit needs to carry on. God invites me to trust in divine love so that when the still waters run thick with crazy blood, my soul is restored. God leads me down paths of giving my testimony for the sake of healing. Even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of mental illness, I will fear no evil, for God is with me. God's Spirit comforts me. God prepares a table for all who carry the cross of mental illness. And God makes sure there's an abundance of everything for everyone. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my crazy life. And I will be blessed. I will be blessed by the presence of God and God's healing light and love forever. Thanks be to God. Amen.
I don't know where Sarah is. Thank you, Sarah. Hello. So the power of the sharing of her story. I just wonder, you don't have to answer this, but I just want to ask you a question. As you sit with, in your skin, in your mind, in your heart, in your body right now, what are you noticing? How have you been impacted, touched by what you've heard, by what you've witnessed in the power of a testimony, a story, a witness to the human experience? And I'm a CPE supervisor, so I could easily get into the touchy-feely, how do you feel about this? But okay. So I'm asking it rather rhetorically, but if you want to say out loud, feel free to do that. If there's a word or words that name your inner experience right now of how this has touched you, I want you to feel free to do that. And if just within your heart you just want to get in touch with what is coming up for you, what are you noticing as you were with Sarah in this time? Just notice. Blessed. Yeah. Could you say that again? Truth. Invitation to be real. Transparency. Say again. Fragility. Light in the darkness. Yeah. Community. A sister in Christ. I want you to percolate with that a little bit. We all have our stories. We've all been touched in some way. If you weren't before tonight, you are now touched by mental illness. And if you're aware of what you carry in terms of, like Pink Floyd's song, being comfortably numb, there's a power of denial that gets us through. It helps us survive. It has its place. As chaplains, I teach students, it's not up to us to blow away a person's denial. It's part of what's helping them survive right now. But there is a power in naming and being with. Shame thrives in secrecy and silence. So just notice that in your own story, and however you need to get in touch with that, whether it's journaling, journal praying, labyrinth walking, being in nature, petting your dog or cat, being alone in silence, whatever it is, I hope that can be part of the result of this time, that we get in touch with what is our story, that what's been named for Sarah is part of our common human experience. And as we do that, it gets us in touch with how can I then companion others and allow myself to be companioned. So I just want to say thank you for your courage. A lot of words came up for me because I do journal a lot. But I thought about vulnerability, the power of naming, the power of joining, power in numbers, the power of labels. Also the sense of, I remember when I went through a time, my first marriage, my wife left me. And I remember thinking, everyone's going to be just repelled by me as soon as they know that part of my story. Strangely, they were drawn to me. Didn't expect that. And just notice that in some of the words that we shared, I sense we feel more drawn to Sarah, like she's a sister, than the other way around. Yes? Do we notice that? So just notice that as you would be vulnerable with others that are worthy of your trust, not everybody is. Just remember that. That there's power in people sharing and having it named. So just notice that too. So that's probably all I have. I know you're tired. It's been a long day. We want to remind you tomorrow morning the doors open at 7:45. There will be things to munch, I think Danish and coffee. The resource table will be open and our first session starts at 8:30. So be gentle, compassionate with yourselves and each other. Get home safely. Rest well. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah.